time.
Good morning. I'm Sandra P., and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. As many of you know, Rosemary E. is my Al-Anon sponsor, so I feel very privileged to be here today for the opportunity to introduce her. Rosemary works a really strong recovery program, and she is a safe person that I have entrusted to help me with my recovery, and she's very straightforward and is confrontational and does not mind letting me know when I'm not on the straight and narrow. And she works the 12-step program with grace and gratitude. And she does use a few phrases every now and then that I'm not sure are Al-Anon approved. She loves to say, I should have asked more questions when she's talking with me. But anyhow, a sponsor is a program mentor that adds personalization to your recovery. And my sponsor is the best. And so with that, I would like to introduce Rosemary E. With great recovery and a good story. I don't know about this microphone here. I've been watching people wrestle with it. Okay, stay. I'm sure to listen. Okay, I'm Rosemary E. This is my story.
Just speak loud.
I can speak loud.
Yeah, I think if you speak loud.
Okay. It's gonna cut. All right. Okay, I was born into a family of seven people. I was the second of five children. I'm a native Baton Rougean, and I lived in Baton Rouge all but 2 years of my life. I really was from humble beginnings. My dad was raised in a rural setting just outside of Baton Rouge. He was from a hardworking family. I think it was eight children. He was hardworking, strong, outspoken, and had a tremendous commitment to our family. He was a carpenter by trade. He loved to garden. He loved to cook and was known throughout our community as a volunteer cook for large crowds upon special request. My paternal grandfather raised cattle and farmed. My paternal grandmother was a true Southern belle. She raised children. She cooked and baked from scratch. She maintained the household and then donned white cotton gloves on Sunday for church and a wide brim hat with flowers. My dad was the oldest son in the family, and no other boys were born until several children later. Thus, he bore the brunt of some very, very hard physical work. I understand my paternal grandfather was a real pistol and a fireball in his younger days. Gee, I don't know where I get that from. Temperament-wise, my paternal grandmother was married at 16, was very stoic. She was stern on the outside and soft on the inside. My mom was raised in the city from a hardworking family with nine children. My sisters are here, so if I'm wrong, just glaze over it, you know. I lost count. Today that's known as a blended family. My mother is still with us. She's kind, energetic, and positive, and has always stressed forgiveness as part of our character makeup. My mom was the glue in our family. She patched clothes, hurt feelings, and many confrontations that my dad initiated. Mom was a housewife until her mid or late 30s and then worked as a secretary. My maternal grandfather owned a small grocery store, and he was very stern. I think he put the fear of God into a lot of people, but I always remember loving him, and I was not afraid of him. My maternal grandmother was my absolute idol. She was very shy. She was hardworking. She had a sweet sense of humor. I absolutely adored her, and I grieved for her a long time after she died. I was 8 years old at the time. Both my parents' families were very religious and lived by high morals and ethics. I always remember all of my grandparents going to church and practicing their faith in everyday life. I am very thankful that both my parents instill the love of and dedication to family in all of us. I remember being very shy as a young child. I was an introvert and didn't like to be noticed. You heard me right. I was timid. Also, I was intelligent, but I didn't think I was. I always did well in school and loved to learn new things. I was built small, but never had any problems in school with bullying or being pushed around. That may not seem significant now, but in this day and time, bullying is a huge part of school life. I knew someone that was bullied, although I didn't know about it till I was an adult, and it bothered me a lot. I've always been partial to the underdog. I have always wanted people to be treated right and abhorrent when someone is ostracized or treated unfairly. I recall being told by various people that I spoke up about injustices and said the things that they wanted to say out loud. Funny, but I don't remember being so bold. I have three sisters and a brother whom I remain close to this very day, and I'm going to embarrass the hell out of them by introducing them. My sister Linda is from Mandeville. My sister Rosalind lives in Baton Rouge. My sister Pam, who also lives in Baton Rouge, and my brother skipped out and who knows where he is. No, he worked today. I'm very, very blessed to have siblings and lots of cousins that I remain close to. And although I'm most appreciative of the Al-Anon program and the support that I've gotten from it, I've been very fortunate to have siblings I can always count on. Through thick and thin, we have had a family catering and event planning business for more than 30 years. We don't have a name for the business, and we're not incorporated because it's not really a business. But we constantly throw parties, tailgate parties, showers, crawfish boils, barbecues, and celebrations for members of our family year-round. We can do a mobile party, take it to another state, or we can make it happen at the beach. We are very well versed in planning and giving various kinds of celebrations for family members. My siblings are my own private support group. Among us, there is always someone going through some kind of crisis. My family was a huge support to me when I was living with active alcoholism. I am especially proud of the way my brothers-in-law never took an active role in any criticism of me or my husband. They never took it personally when we decided to separate, even though they were very close to my husband. They let our problems be our problems, and for that I'm grateful. At about age 16, I broke out of my shyness and became more outgoing. I'm not sure what was the event or activity that had that impact on me, but I remember becoming a lot more social and outgoing at this age. I did a fair amount of dating from the age of 16 on. After graduation from high school, I attended LSU here in Baton Rouge. Although I lived at home and commuted to campus every day, I felt like I became alive when I started college. I love the independence of having to move around a huge campus for classes, and I've always loved learning. I always held part-time jobs and went to school and had earned money for my clothes since the age of 15. We were never in a position to just ask our parents for spending money. I either had a part-time job or babysat or both, and so did my sisters. I met my husband when I was a senior at LSU. We had a date for Mardi Gras. Now, I should ask more questions. We met a few weeks before Mardi Gras. We dated for 2.5 years before we became engaged. We had common core values, and we had a lot of fun together. We both loved to dance and drink and party. I didn't notice any excessive drinking at the time. I believe that's called La La Land. I actually do remember alarms going off at different times during our dating with regard to our differences. Of course, I just ignored them because surely they would go away. The alarms were actually screaming and blaring, sometimes with confetti falling all around me. I did, however, ignore the warnings with persistence. When talk of us getting married began, I remember I had always dreamed of having a big celebration for my wedding. My fiancé, however, absolutely refused and wanted to have only a handful of people at our wedding. Well, heck, just my immediate family is a handful of people. So I settled for a small wedding at our church and a reception at my parents' house, which I really didn't want. So little did I know that this started my career in settling for things. I began to have the makings of a classic victim. I was afraid to speak my mind, afraid to give my opinions, and I was afraid to stand up for what I believed. I know you think I'm lying, but that's true. My outward appearance and behavior did not reveal that part of my personality. I may have had an opinion about which movie to see or which restaurant to visit, but I was afraid and hesitant to express my opinion. During our marriage, it eventually got to the point that I could not shop for something to wear because I couldn't decide if it was something I liked or that my husband liked. My usual script was, "It doesn't matter to me, whatever you want to do, etc., etc." Mind you now, my husband did not insist on his way, but I perceived it this way. I never felt comfortable speaking my own mind and would rarely engage in heated discussions of any kind. I would do anything to avoid an argument, a fight, or a disagreement. I would pout and give my husband the silent treatment without ever explaining why. I did not realize how much of my serenity and freedom I had given away until I had been in this program for quite a few years. This is one of the things that I had the courage to change. I have learned that I can respectfully disagree with someone or agree to disagree. I can say what I mean and mean what I say and not say it mean. After we were married, we had two wonderful sons for which I did most of the child rearing, which was probably not uncommon in those days. However, my upbringing taught me that the mother or the wife bears the brunt of the household and the child-rearing decisions. I do remember secretly wanting my husband to do more around the house, but I never said anything about it. I thought he should know that. Family life for young families is stressful enough, but I added to the mix by going to graduate school for my master's degree and plus 30 hours while I worked full-time. Or as a friend of mine says, I went to graduate school. My husband traveled a lot for his job, so he was not at home a lot, but he did participate in family activities. He loved his family, but the difference in the display of affection between his family and mine were great. And he told me once that just because he never sees them doesn't mean he doesn't love them. His drinking did not become pronounced until we had been married for about 10 years. At that particular time, his father became critically ill. He had lung cancer, and he needed to be cared for. And my husband would come in from work from out of town and go out of town to visit his father and to take care of him. He did this quite often. And this was a difficult period for us because I worked full-time. We had two small sons. I noticed throughout this period that my husband's drinking intensified considerably. His dad suffered with lung cancer and treatment for about 3 to 4 years. When we went to my father-in-law's funeral, one of my husband's cousins told me that my husband had been drinking quite a lot and she was worried about him. That was actually the first clue that I had about how much drinking he was doing. I know that my father-in-law's illness took quite a toll on my husband and as his parents had sheltered him from anything unpleasant in his life. He never visited anyone that was sick or dying and never attended a funeral. I found this odd. Even as a small child, I did not find it disturbing to be around sick or dying people in our family. My husband's behavior changed dramatically after the passing of his father. He was not really a participant in the family dynamics. His drinking was the most important thing to him. As time passed, I noticed that his drinking was progressing. He did not leave the house to drink, but I wish that he would have. I remember sharing my worries about his drinking one day with a friend at work. She looked at me very calmly and said, "Rosie, I think your husband's an alcoholic. You need to go to Al-Anon. Why don't you meet me tonight at a meeting? I will attend the AA meeting while you attend the Al-Anon meeting." And that was probably about 30 years ago. And I will be forever grateful to her. The first Al-Anon meeting I attended was scary as hell. I mean, these people were talking about going to this stuff the rest of their lives. What? You mean this stuff drags out after tonight? I was frightened, and I did not attend again for 4 or 5 months. But I knew I needed something. Finally, a friend of my husband's who was in AA encouraged me to attend the Al-Anon meeting where he attended AA. He was a good friend to our family and to both of us, and he invited me to meet him there, where he brought me around to the Al-Anon people and introduced me and asked them if I could give them a call if I needed to talk. And for this, I am extremely grateful. Recovery was a very slow process for me, but I did begin to work the program, yet not very well. I started attending meetings on my own, and I got a sponsor. And she was a sweet little lady that would hold my hands and sing Kumbaya. I was careful not to choose someone that would tell me what I needed to hear. I very craftily picked someone who would tell me what I wanted to hear. My shyness, of course, was still a problem for me when I first joined the program. I was scared to death to speak out in meetings. I worked hard to overcome this. It took me almost a year before I was able to share anything but my name. We call that remedial learners in my field. I did not work the steps for quite some time. And when I did, I worked them by myself. I never asked for help. I didn't ask for help from my sponsor, and I did not interact very much with Al-Anon people after the meetings. I dreaded going to meetings when my husband was in town. He would show his anger or disapproval by pouting and not speaking to me. But the odd thing was, we never really had a conversation about why I wanted to go to Al-Anon. And there was deafening silence in the house. I had the communication skills of a gnat. Now, those of you whom I sponsor, you might hear me say quite frequently how important communication is to any relationship. This stems from my own inability to communicate as a child and as a young adult. This is a huge regret I have, the inability to effectively communicate. I would clam up and I would become silent. I would brood for days on end and never really say what I meant. I expected everyone to read my mind, particularly my husband. And this is another one of the things that I have had the courage to change, and it is ongoing. One particular aha moment to me came when I was visiting one of my sisters at her house. My niece spilled something on the carpet in her room, and it was a new house. So my sister very calmly told her to get a dish towel and dampen it and go upstairs and blot the stain. And it hit me that this incident would have been blown so out of proportion at our house. My husband would have yelled just the same for a spilled drink as a gasoline explosion. I was so struck by the fact that my sister handled this so calmly. And I would have reacted with fear when my husband exploded over the simplest things. I vowed at that moment to try to change my reaction to smaller things in life so that they don't become the larger things. I had to take a look at my perspective on life. And I don't know if any of you have heard of the broken windows theory. And I heard about this some years ago when they were talking about reforming the crime in New York, and the current administration there would talk about the broken windows theory. And what they did was they were told, the police force and everyone there were told, that even if something as small as a broken window happens, report it and change it and get it done. And then that will lead to larger things, bigger things being taken care of. And that's how they turned around some of the problems that they were having in that city. But anyway, I like that analogy, and I do believe that. I think sometimes if we start with the smaller things, they do lead to the bigger things. We plodded along for several more years, during which time I was consumed with worry, anxiety, and fear. I would like to say here that there were many good times in our marriage. It was not all doom and gloom. But the disease eventually took a toll on our relationship, and it crippled me mentally and spiritually. I was afraid for my children, not for their physical harm, but for the things that they were experiencing with their parents. There was never any physical abuse, but there sure was a lot of emotional chaos from my husband and me. I tried unsuccessfully to do an intervention with my two young sons by my side, and it went terrible. I should have asked for help, and I did not. I've cried a river of tears over this failure. I felt like I failed my children. And even though I no longer cry about this, I sure do wish I would have been open to getting help for doing an intervention. I know that a good friend in Al-Anon was trying to make me feel better when I was crying about it in a meeting one time, but he just said, "No intervention is a failure." But anyway, it took me quite a while to get through that, the fact that I did not ask for help. I was used to running the whole show and could not get used to something not being done my way. During that time, I was really squeaky clean. I took a lot of showers early in recovery because I could cry in there and no one would notice me. The thought of my children possibly becoming alcoholics absolutely scared me to death. When I wasn't taking showers, I would take my so-called punishment in silence, because you know it is golden. I was prone to depression, and my persistence in carrying my heavy burden took over my life. My husband always knew when I was at the end of my rope and would ease up on the drinking and the craziness for about 4 to 6 weeks. This seemed to be the magic time frame for him. Craziness such as making a scene in public, saying obnoxious comments around the neighbors, or taking my family mud riding in the back of his truck on Christmas Day in your dress clothes, sisters. That was a several hundred dollar mistake, I think, that day. The things that he did when he were drunk were completely unlike him when he was sober. During this time, we built a home in a great neighborhood, and we had fun building the house. We did not come to blows like a lot of couples say happened to them when they build a house. Our neighborhood was great, and so were our neighbors. There were six families, and we became very close-knit. We got together for lots of things, and it seemed like almost like another family. There was lots and lots of drinking among the men. We had wonderful times with our neighbors, but there was a lot of dysfunction with all the drinking. Today, only two of the six couples are still together. One event that changed our lives forever was a one weekend when my husband and I attended a company function in New Orleans. Things got crazy, and we ended up having a huge disagreement about his behavior. It was one of these weekends with lots of fun things planned for a huge crowd of people. Of course, there was lots of drinking, and we wouldn't have to drive because we could take cabs or we could walk. But anyway, he made a big mess of the weekend, and I vowed to leave him because I just couldn't tolerate the madness anymore. By this time, he had probably been drinking heavily for about 6 years, and I just wanted him to quit drinking. And I had such a swell plan of recovery for him, too. I never thought of myself as controlling, but it drove me crazy that I could not control his drinking or his recovery or lack thereof. I was used to running everything very efficiently. There was a power struggle that I had never known, and I hated it. I worked efficiently. I ran the household efficiently. I really was feeling trapped, helpless, and hopeless. But my husband was very intuitive and could read people very well. He could expertly predict when I had had enough of the craziness and when I was at the end of my rope, still again. He would say and do things to give me just enough hope to keep me in the marriage. After this particular company weekend, I was determined to leave him, but then he dangled the proverbial carrot in front of me. He was offered a chance to move overseas for his job. At first, we thought we were going to Norway, but it ended up being Scotland. Now, I had been to Europe several times as an adult. I had not traveled very much at all as a child. After I taught middle school at a really good school for several years, I decided to venture out, and I did student tours around the world. I led student tours to Europe, Mexico, and Canada for several years. Now, I must have been nuts. I had the travel bug, and the thought of living in Europe for a brief period of time seemed like a fantastic adventure to me. Also, I wanted our children to have this experience, not just for the adventure, but to learn that people in different countries and in different cultures live differently, and it's still okay. This overseas opportunity could not have come at a better time. At this point, I was pumped up, and I was ready for a new life. Well, we all know where those geographic cures lead us. My husband vowed that this would be a new start for us because, heads up, you're going to like number one, alcohol is too expensive in Europe, and it would not be cost effective to purchase so much. And number two, it would be a great experience for our family in our new lives. Now, if I were a betting woman, I would bet that number one is a crock. Alcohol is too expensive. But he was right. Alcohol and many other things in Scotland cost 3 to 5 times more than they did here. Gasoline was, I guess, $8 or $9 a gallon. This is back in 1992. Everything was expensive. Very, very, very expensive. And lucky for us, the alcohol there had twice the, I mean, yeah, the beer had twice the alcohol content of the U.S. beer. And they served it in pints. A pint of lager. He loved a pint of lager. Oh, my goodness. But number two proved to be true. It actually was a great experience for my family. So we packed up our gear and headed for Scotland. Never had I left Louisiana for anything but a vacation. I had always lived in Baton Rouge, but I knew I would love it there, and love it I did. I studied maps of the town in which we lived and got a general lay of the land. My husband's company provided us with lots of information about the culture there and many details about life in Scotland. They paid for our sons to go to a private international school and paid for housing. The minute the plane touched down, I began searching for Al-Anon meetings. I learned to drive on the wrong side of the road. I took the train, the bus, and taxis everywhere. But you can imagine my husband drinking stepped up considerably. And yes, alcohol did cost more in Scotland, but this was no deterrent. Our 2 years overseas was the first time in my adult life that I had not worked outside our home. I became active in an organization for overseas wives, and I headed the Tours and Travel Committee for a club of 400 members. I really liked having friends from all over the globe. I was also elected to the board of directors of the international school that my sons attended. I played golf, I did forest walks, I planned tours around Scotland, I organized a Christmas market trip to Germany, led a group to tour the China factories in England, took French conversation lessons, organized family photos into albums, substitute taught at the international school, taught youth classes at our church, and more. Our family experienced things that we would never have experienced here in the States. Our sons were teenagers and became quite versed in traveling. For spring break, they would visit the beaches of Normandy or go to Italy. If they'd have been here, they'd have been to Biloxi or Gulfport or Port Allen, I don't know, something like that. And then we went, my husband and I did a good bit of traveling also, and but one trip that we did, we all went to Northern Africa to a resort there. It was Tunisia. I wouldn't advise it. Well, I must have missed the fine print in the brochure, because when I booked it, I didn't realize that it was a topless beach resort. Men, this doesn't apply to you, but ladies, have you ever been to a topless beach resort with your teenage sons? And just an FYI, their mother did not go topless. Well, all the guys, including my husband, had neck and eye strain for quite a while after that trip. And their mother vowed to read the fine print more closely in travel material. But actually, topless beaches are much more common in Europe and Africa than here in the States. My life seemingly was a dream come true. I will be forever grateful for that overseas opportunity, but we certainly had our share of troubles with regard to his addiction. I learned to work a good program of recovery in Scotland. I always say in those times that it costs $2 a minute to call home and whine. So I began working the program more faithfully. Actually, the first time I spoke at a convention was in Scotland. There are things about the program there that I really liked, and of course there are most of the things here that I really like, but their meetings were 2 hours long, and you broke halfway through for tea and coffee and biscuits, which are cookies. But I know sometimes in meetings, especially when the discussion gets going, an hour flies by. But anyway, it worked. It worked really well. Another difference is that they begin with the Lord's Prayer and they end with the Serenity Prayer. And I really have no preference over that. It was just different. What I prefer about the program here is that both AA and Al-Anon share more than they did in Scotland. Here, AA and Al-Anon we're encouraged to visit one another's meetings or programs, and over there it is totally separate, and I think it's still that way. There's very, very little mingling at all. There's very little interaction except for what they call open meetings. An open meeting is what we used to call discussion meetings. And you had three speakers, and you had either two AAs and an Al-Anon, or two Al-Anons and one AA. And they spoke for about 30 to 45 minutes each. I had an opportunity to speak at an open meeting there as well. I love the fact that we have meetings 7 days a week, morning, noon, and night. In Scotland, there were only a few meetings a week, and I believe there's still only about three meetings a week, Al-Anon meetings a week, in that community. We can stop by the Al-Anon office and purchase literature here, and there it has to be ordered from Glasgow. Of course, there is Amazon. I know that you can do it from there, but it's just nice, the conveniences that we have. All in all, it's a miraculous program that works for people worldwide. Bill and Lois would be absolutely stunned at the effectiveness of this grassroots initiative of theirs. Another thing, in Scotland, when you're drunk, you're pissed. My mother hates that word, but if you use it to be angry, she hates it. But anyway, over there, when you're pissed, you're drunk. That was kind of interesting for me to get used to also, because I was so pissed anyway, you know. I was a mad mama, I'm going to tell you what. I have this theory that if we hired angry, untreated Al-Anons in all the major airports in this country, take care of that terrorist problem straight away, girls. Seriously. During our overseas adventure, I had the time of my life, mostly. It was a fairy tale life, but with a big old monster lurking in the shadows, and that was addiction. We lived in a small town in Scotland, and back then there was only one takeout. We say takeout, they say takeaway. It was Chinese food, and there were no drive-through restaurants at the time, so I had to cook or we would starve, which I did anyway. I was very busy, and I really enjoyed life.
Kill him.
Okay. Tell him I'm busy. Except, of course, for the drinking bouts and my husband's antics, which were happening more and more. Another thing that happened in our second year was that my husband gave up driving. Scotland had and still does have very stringent rules against what they call drink driving. Your license is revoked with possible jail time no matter what. One of our neighbors was a judge, and he had gotten a DUI several years prior to us arriving, and he had his license suspended for 18 months. Anyway, my husband decided on his own to give up driving. Besides, the roads and streets were very narrow and winding, and most were quite treacherous. Luckily, our oldest son, who turned 17 in the second year, could drive, help me with the drive, and it was a tremendous help to me. I drove my husband and me around in sometimes icy conditions. I'm not fond of driving in the snow or the sleet, and this was certainly no exception there. Another huge issue was that the pub owners allowed the teenagers, to purchase alcohol even if they could hold a cup. The Americans tried to put pressure on the police to enforce the drinking law, and there was a drinking law, it just wasn't enforced. But they had very little luck. However, since the driving age is 17 years old there, many of the teenagers do not drive, and that was somewhat of a relief when our sons went out and we knew they'd be taking the bus or taking a taxi or walking home. It was a tremendous relief knowing that they were out at night and they wouldn't be behind the wheel of the car. At the end of our second year there, we found out we were being transferred back to the States, and I made a decision to separate after 21 years of marriage. I had asked my husband to go with me to counseling for several years on several different occasions. And as I used to say, only half of the marriage went. Me. I used to think our marriage reminded me of a boxing match where both the boxers are worn out and they begin draping themselves over one another and they're just kind of slugging these half-hearted punches, and that's what we reminded me of. I was worn out from trying to get him to quit drinking at that point in our marriage, and the stress and the fear paralyzed me. I never felt rested. I wanted to think about some of my options. I needed to be away from the stress. My husband was insistent that I either divorce him or go back with him. I did not want to divorce him at the time, but did not speak up once again. He kept pressuring me to make a decision, so I filed for divorce. But I don't blame him for this. I take responsibility for this myself. If I was not ready to commit to divorcing, then I shouldn't have done it. Just like moving overseas, though, and expecting a glorious lifestyle, I again expected that it would be peaceful at home, and that I would have fun as a single woman to beat the band. But I was miserable. When I moved away from Scotland, I changed everything about myself that wasn't nailed down. I left all of my Al-Anon information. I had a huge library, tapes, books, all kind of things there. You see, I was never going to need it again. Wrong. After sailing through life as a single woman for about 6 months, I knew that I needed something to help me feel better again about myself. My self-worth was at rock bottom. I could not fathom how anyone could love me again, but I wanted someone to love me and take away the empty feeling and the loneliness. I felt like I had made a mess of my life and was so ashamed of being divorced. I was guilty of being arrogant, and I thought I was perfect just because I did not drink to excess. I blamed all of my misery on the alcoholic. I was so intent on his recovery that I neglected my own. I heard this expression from a friend in Al-Anon: if you're not happy with you, then you're not happy with two. I thought that fit. I seemed to be searching for something or someone to make me feel better, but I believe the key to recovery is making yourself feel better. The good news about living in the good old USA is that we are blessed with an abundance of resources for any kind of help. I began to research the various options available to me, and I started working the program like my hair was on fire. I attended 4 to 5 meetings a week. I got a sponsor that was very, very strong and unafraid to veto my bright ideas. I read everything I could get my hands on with regard to addiction and alcoholism. I became more familiar with me. I attended some open AA meetings and was shocked to discover that my defects were very similar to the alcoholics. I just didn't use the bottle. I got help from my sons and Alateen, and when they began to resist going for help, I decided that the best gift I could give my children was a healthier mother. We can tell our children lots of things, but when we show them how to live a good life, that works better. I began to focus more on me and not on the alcoholic. This was another thing that I could change. I started to see my defects and prayed for my higher power to help me with them. This was a slow, gradual process. During this time, I prayed to have a better relationship with my father. Al-Anon gave me the courage to change this relationship. My dad was temperamental, opinionated, stubborn, hardworking, kind, and a big old tough guy with a soft center. I was just afraid of him, and I had never been particularly close to him. I decided to pray for him for health, success, and happiness. And I did this for several months. I also prayed for 4 other people for whom I held a resentment. I didn't realize anything particularly miraculous happening after a while. I did, however, realize one day that the resentment for these 4 people seemed to go away. Then it occurred to me to buy season tickets to the LSU baseball games and go with my dad to the games. My dad had gone to the baseball games for 7 or 8 years and loved it. My dad was not very demonstrative. When he answered the phone, you would swear he hated you. Hello! Or, you know, yeah! So I decided to break the news to him that I would like to join him in attending the LSU baseball games. He agreed and seemed happy about it. However, there wasn't a lot of difference between my dad's elation and just being pleased. I think my dad would have had the same reaction if he had won the lottery or if he had won a bouquet of radishes. No difference. However, this did start a new chapter for me with my relationship with my dad. We not only rode together to the games, but I started appreciating my dad for the good man that he was. He was admired and loved by the people he sat near. He sat near them for over 7 years. My dad, I told you, he was a carpenter, so he was pretty tough. Well, he would catch the stray fly balls in the stands barehanded. Now, have you ever seen one of those little suckers come across? I'm going to tell you what, it'll sting the hell out of you. But anyway, Daddy caught these balls like they were ping pong balls. And he saved them as souvenirs, brought them home as souvenirs. When he became ill and quit going to the games, his friend at Alec Box would often ask about him. For years, I had been used to people criticizing my dad, including his family. But I rarely heard anyone compliment him. It was sheer joy to see him in a different light. As I practiced the program with more fidelity, I gradually became less sarcastic and less negative and began to see the glass half full. I became braver in meetings. It was so difficult for me to speak up in meetings. I vowed to attend at least 1 active meeting a week, and I call the active meetings one in which I share and passive meetings one in which I don't share. That's just my own little thing. After we had been divorced several years, I thought it was time to make amends to my husband for my part in the craziness. Now, prior to this, I was pretty angry with him because 2 years after we divorced, he got sober. You know, yeah. So, like hell I'm going to make amends to him. He owes me. But anyway, I worked through that. Thank you, thank you. So anyway, we met for lunch one day, and I made amends to him for my part in the craziness. Prior to that, I was pretty cocky. Of course, I thought he should make amends to me. But eventually, I began to see my part of the things, and for my own peace and serenity, I was very okay with making amends to him. It does not matter if someone does not make amends to me. I learned to love life so much. This, however, was a gradual change for me. Now, rarely a day goes by when I am not grateful for a great life. My checks and balances learned through this program of recovery have enabled me to be thankful for what I have and to give thanks daily to my higher power. Do I have down moments? Absolutely. But I don't stay there quite so long. I have the tools to cope with the downs, and I also know that I am going to rebound. I have to say that at one particular time, when my dad was dying, I felt like I was in the black hole. I was not suicidal, but I just kind of wanted to be taken out of this life for a while till things got better. Thankfully, one of my sisters, Linda, calmly asked me one day if I intended to take my life. I did not intend to, but I was thankful that she caught my despair and encouraged me to seek help. My friend Sandra also encouraged me to see my physician immediately and tell him what was going on, and I'm grateful to you both for this. I quit expecting instant solutions to my problems. I grew to have more patience in resolving things in my life. I also grew to see that there are often more options in resolving problems than I was aware of. I may not like all the options, but usually there are more options to consider. I learned to take responsibility for my actions. We all have reasons why we say or do the things we do, but no matter what or who caused us to be a certain way, is no excuse not to take responsibility for doing things better. I learned something clever from someone in my group in Scotland. It's so simple that it just escaped me. I discovered that when someone would ask the question, "Would you do me a favor?" because I would instantly say, "Sure," no matter what it was. But anyway, they taught me to say, "If I can." This was so simple, so easy. But it kind of gives you a little bit of downtime to think about what it is they're actually asking you to do. It gives you time to think about what is being asked of you. This is one of my more difficult accomplishments, but I've gradually learned to quit obsessing over things in bed at night to the point of passing many sleepless nights. I now pray for what I worry about and try to give myself a time limit as to how long I can let this thing occupy my thoughts. I guess this is acceptance of what I cannot change. I also learned that sometimes my obsessing over an issue is because I have not communicated with the proper person about it. I have also learned that my body simply will not tolerate obsessing over something. If I have an issue with someone, I have to resolve it or it will eat at me. I have learned that this is not good for my physical or my mental health. When I pray for anything or anyone, I add my name to the top of the list. This has taught me to put myself and my recovery first. I attend Al-Anon workshops and conventions. I became a group representative and a district representative, but I made a decision during that time to vacate the positions in order to devote more time to caring to my dad. At that time, he was very ill, and I do not regret that decision. I organized a workshop and a Heritage Day luncheon. This is also another thing that has been very difficult for me and has come extremely slowly for me, and that's asking for help. Since when did I become so perfect that I don't need to ask for help? The more I ask for help, the easier it is to ask for help again. My friend Sandra has also helped me with this tremendously. She is always available to me and always offers to help me with many, many things. Instead of fussing at me for not asking her for help, she will kindly ask me to please call her whenever a situation arises that I would like to just talk about. I did not know Sandra very well when she asked me to be her sponsor. Gradually, we became the closest of friends, although we started out as sponsee. She is now an endeared member of my family, and my brother, who started out with four sisters, finally refers to her as number five. However, I do earn my pay. As Sandra's sponsor. I had to say it. My sister Rosalind became active in Al-Anon a few years ago, and that has been nice because there is someone close to me that knows my stuff and can relate. It is also really cool to see my sister grow through this program of recovery and get mentally healthier. I started doing informal, private step sessions for women who want to work the steps. I have worked with small groups or individuals for, 10 or 15 years, and I still do this. I usually do this in the privacy.
I'm sorry. Would the owner of a yellow Saturn sports car, it's blocking a wedding party getting ready to come in to use the other room? Thank you.
Okay. No problem. I do the step sessions in the privacy of my home for safety reasons and for anonymity. I wanted this to be a place where we could have healthy discussions and voice concerns yet be appreciated. I make a point of telling everyone that I do step work with that I am not the authority on the program. I do not have the answers to everything, nor am I always right. If there is something that I point out or discuss that you feel uncomfortable with, I say please use your own judgment. If your sponsor tells you something different from the method I use, then that's okay too. My whole objective is to get people in Al-Anon to work those steps so the steps can start to become a part of your everyday life. To me, the steps are just a good recipe for life. Another thing I've learned is to passionately guard my serenity and peace and not sell it short again. I tell the people I sponsor that I care about the recovery of their husbands, boyfriends, sons, daughters, etc., but my primary concern is your recovery. I actually use a lot stronger language than that. You get it. I believe that as Al-Anons, we sometimes fall short in this respect. As Al-Anons, we tend to make sure everyone is served first and that we take the leftovers. I believe that we do not guard our serenity and peace. If we do not guard our serenity and peace, then who will? When we get better, things get better. The step sessions have proven to be more than I could have ever imagined. Every time I go through the steps with someone, I discover something new about myself. It is a constant reminder to me of how much I've grown and progressed in recovery. To all of the women with whom I have worked the steps, a million thanks to you for allowing me to be part of your recovery. Thanks for trusting me to go with you to a better place in your life, hopefully. I'm also well aware that there are times you could punch me in the nose because I do not tell you what you want to hear, but what I feel you need to hear. To all of the women that I have sponsored, I salute you. You are some of the bravest, strongest, most compassionate, kindest, and most adventurous group I have ever known. You taught me more than I ever taught you. You helped me to believe in myself again. You showed me I am loving and lovable. And I am also well aware that you could wring my neck from time to time also. Bottom line, folks, recovery ain't for sissies. Today, I lead a very active life. I have and always have had an extremely deep love and appreciation for my family, my biological family, my friends, and my Al-Anon family. I treasure holidays and gatherings with family and friends. However, I still have ups and downs. Like everyone else, I have learned how to handle them better. I had another huge aha moment this past Christmas. I was feeling somewhat down as the holidays approached, and I decided to try and practice what I preach. And so I went to more meetings, and I called my sponsor more, and on and on and on, and eureka, success. So another thing I did was to agree to go with my siblings to a holiday concert downtown. We visited several, I think it was at like six different churches, six different denominations downtown for this Christmas event. So on the day that we met, I was feeling kind of low anyway, and I was pretty grumpy. And so they wanted to get something quick to eat and go on to the churches. And so they said, well, let's just go to McDonald's, please. So I was grumpy about going to McDonald's. I was just griping about that. So anyway, so we parked by the first church, and we knocked several times on the doors, and it's not open, and the lights are not on. And so we go to the second door, and we knock, and the lights are not on, and there's no life. And so I think we went to four doors, maybe. There wasn't a basement, or we'd have tried that, too. There was no sign of life, so after trying to enter all the doors without success, we returned to the car. And it was then that our brother looked up the event on his phone, only to discover that we had gone on the wrong night to the Christmas concert. Now, I did offer to sing Christmas carols in the car to my siblings, but they adamantly refused. You just can't please some people. I actually laughed enough at our faux pas that I was no longer in a lousy mood. But alas, before we ended the evening, one of my sisters discovered that she had left her new cell phone at one of the schools she worked in. So we all agreed to go with her to the school, even though it was nighttime. Perhaps the cleaning crew would be there and could open the door for us. So we proceed to an unsavory area of town, and my sister parks the car. So we get out the car, and we're getting ready to knock on the door. And then I notice a man lying on the curb in front of our car that I suspect was a liquored up man. A lady was walking by him and bends down and says, "Are you all right, sir?" Well, I immediately go into a panic mode and start yelling for everybody, "Get back in the car! Get back in the car!" So we immediately get back in the car, and we decided my sister can look for her cell phone the next day. But the upshot of this adventure was that I was personally pleased that I had missed another opportunity to meet a liquored up man. Now, if he would have been sitting up on the curb, I may have entertained thoughts of him. But no, I do have my standards. He was lying down. The bottom line is, my point in all of this is that I felt wonderful that night, and I forgot all about my whining and my troubles. I have learned that it's not too late to have a good day. It was 9 o'clock at night, but it was not too late to have a good day. 2014 was somewhat trying for me. I was diagnosed with osteoarthritis, and I had a close call with breast cancer all within a four-month period. In the end, I was told by my rheumatologist to get my you-know-what off the couch and get moving. I immediately joined a fitness center and have continued to go to the gym several times a week for almost 12 months. I rarely have arthritis pain. Then I went through several months of tests, more tests, a lumpectomy, and finally it was determined I did not have breast cancer. However, I discussed this with my sons prior to the final determination and told them if I do, I'll deal with it. I'll gather lots of information, I'll speak to women who have been there, and choose a course of action, but I will be okay. Just had my six-month checkup. The girls are good. I am the very proud mother of two grown sons. They are both healthy, hardworking young family men. They are adored by their children and lead very good lives. Sometimes I hurt for them because their dad has become dependent on them. Their dad had a stroke and became very ill for a long time. He continues to drink and smoke to excess, which compounds his health issues. My sons, especially my oldest, deals with it the best way they can. I don't get involved in their relationship with their dad. But I do sympathize with them, and I truly admire their courage and their strength. I have absolutely been gloriously blessed with two fantastic daughters-in-law. Rachel and Jenny are the salt of the earth, and so are their families. Both of their families love my sons beyond words, and I love them. I try very hard not to interfere in their lives and not to give them the benefit of my wisdom too often. I am madly in love with my five grandchildren and love it when they spend time with me. We bake cookies together, hunt for pine cones, go to the swimming pool, play games together, dance in my kitchen, work in the flower bed, open up a concession stand with chips and lemonade in my garage, and all sorts of neat things. I believe in doing free stuff with kids. 4 years ago, our family had another huge milestone event that changed our lives forever. My youngest son and daughter-in-law had their first child, who was diagnosed with a rare disease at the age of 9 months. Carson had started missing her developmental milestones that are common in most children. And after seeing several doctors and getting no answers, they finally saw a geneticist, and it was discovered that Carson has a rare disease, and it's a chromosome disorder. It can affect all of the major systems in a child's body, cardiac, respiratory, digestive, etc. In addition, she could become blind or deaf. She is nonverbal because she does not have the TCF4 gene, that's gene 21.2 in the 18th chromosome, just if you want to know. She will possibly only have the intelligence of a 12 to 18 month old. And we have no definitive research as to her lifespan. We just don't know. This is not well known. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this shook me to the core. Why would this beautiful, sweet, precious child be given such a diagnosis? When we left the geneticist's office with the devastating news, I went home, crawled on my sofa for the weekend, didn't speak to anyone, and didn't function for 2 days. My son headed to go out fishing with some buddies, and my daughter-in-law left to spend the weekend with friends at the beach. Huh? The other grandmother took Carson and kept her for the weekend. Actually, I take very little credit for dealing with Carson's diagnosis on my own. For almost a year, I felt like someone had kicked me in the stomach. My son and his wife were absolute leaders in this fight. They were devastated but forged ahead with their active lives. They looked into every means possible of getting help for Carson. Some of the parents of these children worldwide have started a grassroots organization that raises money for this syndrome, and we have hired 2 researchers at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and they are doing research specifically on this syndrome. My son has held golf tournaments to raise money for the rare diseases, and many other parents have done activities to raise money worldwide. Initially, there were fewer than 250 cases of this in the world that we knew of. This is changing rapidly. I suspect a lot of it just hasn't been identified. My son and daughter-in-law are both professional working parents. They have extremely active social lives and never let Carson's disabilities get in the way of anything. They go boating with her, swimming with her, entertain people constantly at their home. They had their own DNA tested before deciding to have 2 more children. Carson's syndrome could have been inherited or it could have been de novo. In our case, it was de novo. It just happened. It was a fluke. And now Carson has a younger sister and a younger brother. My son and daughter-in-law built a home on her parents' 25-acre plot of land. They have several horses, which the other grandmother has used in equine therapy. The other grandmother is a physical therapist and has done equine therapy for special needs children for over 15 years. Now, what are the chances? This has allowed Carson the benefit of being able to ride horses and become more mobile in her quest to walk. The equine therapy has enabled Carson to walk at age 3.5. Some children with this syndrome never walk, and many do not walk until the age of 9 or 10. My other son and his wife, who also have a son and a daughter, are very active in selling T-shirts and participating in activities for Carson, and have taught their children about what a gift Carson is. Carson and the 2 oldest grandchildren attend the same school and get to see one another regularly. Carson is very active, she's very social, and she loves to be around people. I am very proud that all of my grandchildren have the benefit of growing up with this special needs child. My son truly believes Carson is a gift to them from God, and I believe that now too. I had to lean on both my family, my birth family, and my Al-Anon family for support throughout the beginning of this journey. I cried many days at meetings on Saturday morning, at the office, and sometimes in other meetings. The good news about strong recovery is that you don't worry that someone else hears your problems and if they're going to lose sleep at night hearing your troubles. You already know that the care and empathy shown in this program do not translate to losing sleep over someone else's problems. Accepting the things I cannot change has always been a challenge for me. It is especially difficult to accept that you cannot change someone's bad habits, especially addiction. I have accepted that I cannot change my granddaughter Carson, but I can learn, help her to learn life skills, and I can do things that will enable her to have a good, comfortable life. There's always going to be something or someone I cannot change. I now have more vision and patience to spot these things and prepare myself for it. Changing the things I can has been somewhat easier for me. I can change whether or not I have a good attitude. I can avoid toxic people who are negative and bring me down. I no longer need an answer to my prayers instantly. I no longer fret about the small stuff for very long. It is more important for me to be happy than right. I do remember the first time I heard this in an Al-Anon meeting, and a double winner, God bless him, he looked at me and he said, "Well, is it more important for you to be right or happy?" I nearly lunged for his jugular. I mean, it was damn important for me to be right then. Woo, what do you mean? But now I've discovered that it's not, and in fact, being right just might be overrated sometimes. Finally, I liken my recovery in the Al-Anon program and my adjustment to having a special needs granddaughter this way. You're planning a really fun family trip, and you carefully select the destination. Let's say you've chosen to rent a house on the beach for a week. The whole family's joining in, and we plan for meals for 7 days. You make sure you have lots of snacks. You have beach toys, you have rafts, water toys, sunscreen, sunglasses, sun hats, etc. Everyone piles in the vehicles, and for some reason you head the wrong way. You've taken a detour, and you end up alongside a highway near lots of crawfish ponds. The main and only activity out here is crawfishing. And your family has swimsuits, flip-flops, water toys, rafts. Now, there's nothing wrong with crawfishing and wearing rubber boots and that kind of thing, but the whole family is hugely disappointed when you're expecting to go to a relaxing, beautiful sandy beach, and you end up getting dirty and sweaty and catching crawfish. What a disappointment. You don't have the right clothes. Your idea of a perfect vacation is down the tubes. Everyone is so let down, you almost can't rebound. In the end, however, you decide to make the most of it. You join in the fun, you catch some great mug bugs, and you learn a lot about a different hobby. Now, I know that this is an oversimplification of what my family went through, but you get the picture. The benefits and growth that I have received as a result of marrying an alcoholic and having a special needs grandchild simply cannot be measured. My children and grandchildren, including Carson, have enabled me to love life much more and appreciate life so much more. Carson was recently selected the Queen of Mardi Gras at her pre-K school, and I never in a million years dreamed that I would marry an alcoholic or become involved in Al-Anon, but my love for liquored up men landed me here with you. In addition, this program of recovery opened up a whole new world, a world that allows me to realize that there is more than one way of thinking. There's more than one way of solving problems and more than one way of recovering. Al-Anon has helped me to see that I am the common denominator in all of my life issues. What is my part in it? I also dreamed of having normal, intelligent, active grandchildren, and all of them could talk. But you know what? That didn't happen for me, and I'm very okay with it. My family of origin and my faith work like a well-tuned orchestra with this program of recovery for me. I consider myself very blessed that all of you are part of my life. I firmly believe that with the practice of a healthy program of recovery, we can share the keys to the city. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Joanne, oh, please. Rosemary, don't go too far.
I'm not.
All right. Joanne?
I need a fork and all.
You do it. No way.